Thank you. I'm beginning to wonder whether it was a good idea to admit to that. But anyway, thank you very much for the introduction and for the invitation. Salvatore asked me to talk about these linked themes of sustainability and growth. So I want to say a little bit about what we've done at PLOS with regard to those two things, and then broaden it out and say a bit more about other publishers. And then at the end with a more recent development, which Caroline touched on, which I think could be quite significant in terms of growth of open access. So I'm sure, as you know, PLOS is a non-profit organisation. Our mission, our broad mission, is to make the world scientific and medical literature a public resource to inspire that kind of system-wide change. And so, by doing open access publishing successfully, hopefully we can deliver on that broader mission. In terms of how we're supporting our publishing effort, we're attempting to move away from the kind of prevalent model whereby there's a financial transaction between the publisher and the reader by whatever route that information gets to the reader. So to kind of shift the point at which the money enters this system, so it's further up the chain. It's coming from the same sources, but it's supporting publishing further up the chain so that publishers can recover costs before they publish content. Then there doesn't need to be any financial transaction between the publisher and the reader, and you can achieve open access. So that's what we're trying to do. And specifically, the strategy that we set about doing in 2003 was to begin by launching the best journals we could possibly launch in terms of really highly selective, the best in all regards, and that would put PLOS and open access firmly on the map, and then we'd use that as a foundation to establish a bigger publishing operation, ideally where we could provide a home for an open access home for every publishable paper. We're not for profit, but we're also not for loss, so obviously we have to achieve sustainability and ultimately show that this leads to a literature which is more powerful and more useful. So our little ecosystem of journals it looks like this. PLOS Biology and PLOS Medicine were the flagships, launched first, and then they were joined by the PLOS Community Journals, so-called. They're much more typical of scholarly publishing as a whole. They've also become highly prestigious journals in their own right. And then finally, PLOS One was launched in 2006, and I'll say a little bit more about PLOS One later on, and just so to be clear, the publication fees associated with these three types of journal vary. So at the most expensive end, PLOS Biology and PLOS Medicine cost $2,900, and then you can see at the community journals $2,250 and PLOS One $1,350. So over the years, we've grown a lot, and this is the sort of reddish bars are showing submissions over the years and publications in the kind of lilac colour. So we've grown substantially over the years, and what that's translated into in terms of our financial health is that it's been steadily improving. So what this is showing is the percentage of our total costs that we're covering through operating revenue. So there's no grants or anything, everything, all of that kind of income is excluded. This is operating revenue, and the vast majority of that is coming from article processing fees or publication fees. And so in 2009, we got up to just over 90%. And although the figures aren't completely analysed yet for 2010, it's pretty clear that for the first time we've made a small surplus. So clearly that's a really important landmark for PLOS. It's important for open access, but we're not the first to get there either. So now I want to just say a little bit more about some of the other publishers that have achieved a kind of sustainable open access publishing. So first I want to thank Matt Cockrell from BMC for these numbers. So this is just now showing growth in terms of publications. So as you can see, BMC's on been a pretty strong growth trajectory over the years. It's sort of similar pattern to PLOS, but they've always been a few years ahead of us. Hindawi, who are based in Egypt, another prominent open access publisher. And I would say, all of these publishers are very focused on the kind of core values that Caroline talked about. So Hindawi's achieved pretty impressive growth as well in recent years, and I want to thank Paul Peters for those numbers. Martin Rasmussen from Copernicus shared the rate of growth at Copernicus. It's not quite as impressive in a sense, but they are very much a player in open access publishing, and they are growing steadily And then finally, Bettina Gerner was kind enough to share some data from Springer on the growth of their just open access publishing via the hybrid option. And again, it's growing. It's not as, you know, spectacular, say, as what the BMC Plus and Hindawi are achieving. And you know, that's potentially a point for discussion. I think that's typical of the hybrid option in general in terms of growth. You know, if you put the three rapidly growing organisations together, the picture is quite impressive, and it's sort of interesting to speculate, is that trend going to continue? You know, I don't know the answer to that. Certainly, the three organisations are driving growth. And one final point on this is that we're achieving this kind of growth in different ways. And so this is the thing I just want to highlight here. Biomed Central and Hindawi sharing common, they've really grown by launching more journals and growing those journals. So they both have well, you know, over 200 journals each. PLOS has seven. And yet we're on a similar growth trajectory. And you know, most of that growth is down to one journal, and that's PLOS One, which I want to say more about. I certainly am not arguing that, you know, one approach is better than the other, but that if you are in a position of sustainable, scalable growth, there's more than one way to achieve that. So I want to say some more about PLOS One in the last part of the talk. Now, I should say that PLOS One is really the vision of two of the founders of the Public Library of Science, Pat Brown and Mike Eisen, and they essentially were thinking, before we launched PLOS One, looking at the way in which journals work, and in particular the way journals are used to organise content, both in terms of subject relevance and importance and so on. This is the kind of typical process, which we heard a lot about yesterday. It's a blue box. Some people call it a black box, but you know the articles go through rounds of revision and rejection and review and so on frequently before they find their appropriate journal, because the journal is all important in terms of how you're judging the relevance and importance of it. So it takes a long time, this process. There's a lot of kind of inbuilt redundancy and duplication of effort. So the idea for PLOS One was to begin to think about an alternative way of providing these functions, which might be more efficient. And the real sort of innovation, if you like, in PLOS One is one thing. It's very simple. It's the set of editorial criteria. And so what the editors and reviewers in PLOS One are doing is they're judging whether a piece of work is rigorous, ethically conducted, properly reported, and that the conclusions are justified. In other words, does this work belong in the scientific literature somewhere? And if the answer is yes, it does, then it can be published in PLOS One. So what the editors and reviewers aren't doing is they aren't asking, how important is this work? Is it important enough for my journal? And who's it relevant to? Those questions, the idea is that those questions, those issues, can be left until the post-publication phase, using a variety of different approaches. And I haven't got time to go into the kinds of ideas we have. I just want to mention one thing, which is that every article that's published in PLOS has this tab called metrics. And so we provide article level metrics in terms of usage, and further down the page in terms of things like citations and social bookmarking and blogosphere coverage. There's a lot more we could be doing at the article level. It would be lovely to incorporate some of the data that Victor talked about this morning from Mendeley, for example. And, you know, so the idea is that you can begin to provide indicators and metrics which help people assess and filter content in that way. So back to PLOS One, just in terms of what's it done over the years. It was launched in 2006, the first full year of publishing. So if you just look at the column labeled publications, the first full year of publishing was in 2007. So you can see, you know, it's gone from 1,200 articles. Last year we published over 6,700. I think there's a number quoted yesterday, wasn't quite up to date, but so it's just over 6,700. It's an extraordinary growth in this journal, and you know, I think it now makes it the largest peer-reviewed journal in existence. You know, the numbers are just massive. However you want to look at them, it's run by well over 1,400 academic editors. It's not just about volume, though. Just going back to the point of PLOS One, what we want to do is publish a range of content from the incremental all the way through to the sort of more impactful science, if you want. So, you know, we frequently publish work like this example, not about bottom feeding, but about fungi that feed on ionising radiation. So it's different kind of feeding. But, you know, there's a lot of articles in PLOS One that receive this kind of attention, and you know, one other data point. If you look at the articles published in 2009, over 400 of them have been cited 10 times or more. So, you know, we're publishing content from the incremental, thank you, to this more impactful science as well. And the challenge then is providing now the mechanisms to help sort and filter and assess that content. Now, this success of PLOS ONE has not gone unnoticed, and so the last point I want to make is that a set of kind of PLOS ONE lookalikes or PLOS ONE clones has begun to appear, or have been announced at least. So very quickly, the British Medical Journal announced BMJ Open, which is essentially a clinical version of PLOS ONE last summer. And as you can see there, you know, everything's reviewed, but reviewers are not asked to judge the importance. Readers can make those judgments for themselves. That's what they say, very similar. Sage have launched Sage Open, which is a social science version of PLOS ONE, or at least they've announced it. It's not been launched yet. And again, it's a very similar editorial criteria. American Institute of Physics have launched a physical science version of PLOS ONE. Again, reviewers and editors are not expected to judge the significance of the results, and the editorial criteria are very similar to PLOS ONE. And then most recently, Nature have announced scientific reports covering all of natural science. And once again, everything's reviewed, but it's reviewed to be technically sound. Judgments about the importance of a paper will be made after publication. And then final example, because I think it's interesting, is the Genetic Society of America, who have one journal, Society Publisher, publishing one fantastic journal called Genetics. And, they release all that content after 6 months. They've announced something called G3, which is like a genetics version of PLOS ONE, if you like. And again, the emphasis is on data quality and utility rather than mechanistic insight. And what's interesting to speculate here is that this journal is being launched to allow them to experiment in open access publishing and may ultimately help them with the transition of the journal Genetics to open access. That's pure speculation on my part, but I think it's a very interesting potential strategy. So the common features amongst all of these PLOS ONE lookalikes is that they're open access, they're peer-reviewed for rigour, not impact, that there are post-publication mechanisms, some stated more overtly than others, such as providing metrics to help sort and filter content, that they are supported by publication fees in all cases, they are scalable and potentially could become very, very large if PLOS ONE is anything to go by, and they're built on a strong brand. Now, I think this development is interesting for two reasons. The first reason is the potential to actually accelerate scientific communication, because we are moving potentially away from a situation that I sort of portrayed earlier, where papers go round, multiple rounds of revision. Of course, it's still possible to be rejected in this system, and a substantial number of publications are. Nevertheless, in general, you don't go round and round this cycle. And instead, the article, once it's published, value can be added to that article through the provision of things like metrics or lots of other mechanisms as well, because this is open access content. So, there's a lot of potential here to innovate in that area. So if this kind of model, begins to take off, then, it has the potential to accelerate scientific communication and potentially the research process itself. And then, because these things are scalable and they can grow rapidly, as we've seen with PLOS ONE, it may be overstating it to say the floodgates are about to open, but at least it could accelerate the path towards open access. And so that's the kind of thought that I want to leave you with. Thank you very much.
To add that you started in genetics and you ended up with clones.
Yeah.
Took you 20 years.
I know. I can never get it to work in the lab.
Sorry. I'm sure you have questions for Mark. Who wants to be first? There? Anthony.
Anthony Watkinson, University College London. When PLOS ONE started, it said at the beginning on the first page that the validity of the article had to be completed, full peer review had to be completed by the responses to the article. Now, has Dessus appeared? And I'm not knocking PLOS ONE, because I think it's been wildly successful. I've actually been back to look at the stuff on the Internet Archive to see what it said. I do believe the refereeing is sufficient, as it is, but it did give the impression at the beginning that the idea was the social network would actually provide part of the refereeing. That's not the case now, is it, that view?
So, I think what peer review is attempting to do multiple things in the kind of traditional approach. It's attempting to do what we do on PLOS ONE. I think every journal is trying to do that, to judge whether the work is rigorous and properly conducted and so on. But then peer review is also attempting to do something else. It's attempting to sort out how important a particular piece of work is, where it belongs in the hierarchy of journals and so on. So I think what we're doing, one of the ways I think about this, is that we're sort of disaggregating some of the functions that are traditionally wrapped up in a single process and saying that there are some parts of that, those functions which can be provided and really have to be provided before publication. And there are other parts of the process, particularly the organisation function, the assessment of impact and so on, that are potentially best left until after publication. I would say we haven't delivered fully on that part yet. Article metrics are a step in the direction. The hubs idea, which Caroline alluded to, is another kind of idea about how you can impose organisation on open access content after publication. But I think that's still an area where there's lots of room for creative ideas. I think that's how I'd characterise it.
Another question there.
Maria Bellantone, Springer. We've heard yesterday several times that the practice of rating and commenting on other people's articles hasn't really picked up in the scientific community as much as the publishers would have initially expected. Do you have your own data on that? And would you share this view that it's not yet really picked up, and is there any strategy that you got as, you know, the PLOS to sort of stimulate the scientific community to do more of that?
Yeah. So first of all, I agree. You know, if you just look at the amount of rating and commentary that there is on the PLOS site itself, it's not that impressive. I think it's a valuable facility to have on the site, particularly the commenting function, actually, because there are certain articles that attract quite a lot of post-publication discussion, and so it's great in those rather rare cases, but it's still great to be able to do that. So I would say our strategy is to we launched PLOS ONE, you know, it's nearly 5 years ago when we sort of first were conceptualising PLOS ONE. A lot's changed in that intervening time. So now I think our strategy is much more aimed at what's happening out there, you know, what kind of comments or what kind of activities are being recorded elsewhere on the web, and how can we capture that activity and sort of decorate the article with that. And I think, you know, the Mendeley stuff that we heard about this morning is a fabulous example of the kind of activity that one would want to try and capture and put, if it was possible, on the articles themselves. So that's, I would say, our strategy or how we're thinking about it.
So we have a last question here. The microphone first.
When you say that you cover currently 90% of your operating expenses...
More than that.
Whatever. Yeah. Does this include the upgrades of the platform, or is it okay? So
yeah,
it's
yeah.
like it's, includes depreciation.
It's all costs.
And all costs.
Absolutely everything, yeah.
And so upgrades on the platform are considered as costs,
yes.
Not as investments.
No, they are. They're, that's all part of the costs, yeah.
So let's thank Mark again.